From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As the Republican National Convention rolled out its Just Plain Folks-themed event, emphasizing service and patriotism in the Xcel Energy Center, protests metastasized into riots in the streets of St. Paul, capped as the RNC drew to a close on Thursday with tear gas, percussion grenades, and 400 people arrested. According to the St. Paul Pioneer Press, Monday kicked off a bad week with nearly 300 arrested, among them an Associated Press photographer and Amy Goodman, host of the TV and radio program Democracy Now!, and her crew, all of whom clearly displayed press passes. But reporters saw themselves swept up or even targeted as early as Saturday when the independent video group Eyewitness was detained preemptively in the house that served as its base of operations. The group was there to document police clashes with protesters. In 2004, at the RNC in New York, Eyewitness provided crucial evidence of police misconduct and perjury that caused charges to be dropped against hundreds of protesters. Altogether, as of this writing, a couple dozen reporters have been arrested in St. Paul, a few from the Associated Press and some newspapers, but mainly, it seems, from small and independent media. Tim Carr of the liberal media watchdog group Free Press wrote that, quote, "These local officials think freedom of the press extends only to their allies in the mainstream media." True, few of the mainstream media were caught up in those events. They were fending off more metaphorical assaults inside the hall of the RNC.
The American economy is in extremis. Millions of Americans have no health insurance. Our budget deficits have ballooned to historic heights. Osama bin Laden is still at large, and we're still at war. Which is why, at its convention this week, the Republican Party joined as one to identify, belittle, and confront its foe in this fall's historic election, an opponent that has never been shot down over Vietnam, never had executive experience, and never been a hockey mom. I refer, of course, to the smooth-talking, flag-pin-not-wearing, liberal elitist media.
The Washington sun has been rising in the east. You see, Washington has been looking to the eastern elites, to the editorial pages of the Times and the Post.
The reporting of the past few days had proven tackier than a costume change at a Madonna concert.
The citizens of the United States get to decide our next president. Not the left-wing media, not Hollywood celebrities, not anyone else, but the people of America.
Here's a little newsflash for those reporters and commentators. I'm not going to Washington to seek their good opinion. I'm going to Washington to serve the people of this great country.
That was former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, and former Wasilla, Alaska Mayor Sarah Palin, who 21 months ago became the governor of Alaska and even more recently John McCain's running mate. By the way, on Thursday, McCain accepted the nomination.
Tonight, I have a privilege given few Americans, the privilege of accepting our party's nomination for President of the United States.
But never mind that. If Barack Obama is the rock star of the Democratic Party, Sarah Palin is the superhero of the GOP, a strong but beautiful Wonder Woman from a strange, distant place, imbued with the power to charm a crowd with her homespun biography, thrill with tales of vanquishing special interests, knee Barack Obama in the groin, and, most miraculously of all, coalesce a fractious party around a problematic nominee. Even the nattering nabobs of negativism were pundicizing positively.
On a scale of 1 to 10, Sarah Palin was an 11 last night. I mean, the speech was outstanding. I think it put to bed any questions about whether or not she's ready to be the vice president of the United
States. She is a terrific, she's an excellent speaker, she's intelligent, she's tough, she's arresting, she's interesting.
She really did hit it out of the park tonight, not only here, but for millions of Americans watching across the country. No doubt, Anderson Cooper, Campbell Brown, no doubt their first real impression of her had to be very, very positive.
The choice of Palin also apparently defined the GOP's convention strategy. For when she was named a week earlier, the elitists of the liberal media had the temerity to look into her background. And just as in 1972 and 1984, with Democratic VP picks Thomas Eagleton and Geraldine Ferraro, the press quickly uncovered potential trouble. Within 2 days, reporters and bloggers discovered that as mayor of Wasilla, the special interest taker-oner had hired a Beltway lobbying firm to help secure federal earmarks for her small town. When she boasted of saying thanks but no thanks to the notorious pork project called the Bridge to Nowhere, they found that she'd supported the project until after it became notorious, and then accepted the $233 million anyway. Oh, there was also the firing of the public safety commissioner who'd refused to fire her sister's ex-husband. Oh, and the attempted elimination of the librarian who had refused Palin's wish to ban certain books. This is called reporting, unless you're on the GOP talking points routing list, whereupon it becomes shameless smears. Of course, the most sensitive issue, which surfaced as an answer to spurious blog rumors, was her 17-year-old daughter's pregnancy, a fact that may or may not undercut the governor's family values rhetoric, but which probably bore mentioning, or not. Here's McCain aide Steve Schmidt with Katie Couric of CBS on Tuesday, brandishing a smoking gun of media ruthlessness.
Members of his campaign went to off-the-record lunches with reporters today, and they were asked if she would do paternity tests to prove paternity for her last child. Smear after smear after smear, and it's disgraceful and it's wrong.
Hold on. As blogger Josh Marshall points out, those were questions, not stories. So what smear is he speaking of? And they were asked off the record, at least until Schmidt on network TV himself violated the confidence. But the McCain campaign doesn't seem to quite understand the whole question and answer thing. Here's spokesman Tucker Bounds on CNN Monday with host Campbell Brown.
So explain to us why you think Governor Palin is ready to be commander-in-chief.
Governor Palin has the good fortune of being on the ticket with John McCain, who there is no question is the most experienced and shown proven judgment on the international stage. He understands foreign affairs. He has a familiarity with
the players.
Well, we
know all that about John McCain, Tucker. I asked you about her, though, because we all know the role of the VP, as John McCain has defined it, is to be able to step into the job of the presidency on day one if something should happen to the president. So I'm asking you about her foreign policy experience.
Yeah, Campbell, certainly there are a number of people that are supporting Barack Obama's candidacy and feel like he's experienced enough to take on the Oval Office. Our feeling is
but
that
you're
Governor
not
Palin
answering
has
my question.
Just as much experience as Barack Obama.
Okay,
she
but you set a different standard. That was
candidate of our opponent.
What I'm saying is that you set a different standard by arguing how important it was with John McCain. Mm-hmm. And no one's arguing with you that he has much more experience than Barack Obama. So I'm just trying to get someone from the campaign to explain to me what foreign policy experience she has or what qualifications she has that would allow her to be ready to be commander-in-chief if something should happen to Senator McCain.
Well,
that's
Kim, let me be clear.
I
don't think there should be any problem explaining her experience. She has executive state level experience. She's been in public office reforming Washington.
Offended was the McCain campaign at Brown's shameless question asking that it canceled the candidate's planned appearance later in the week on CNN, where McCain would have been subjected to more vicious attacks by noted pit bull Larry King. Of course, Campbell Brown might be forgiven for not knowing which aspect of the vice president's resume was off limits. On Monday, GOP officials castigated the media for violating the Palin family's privacy. At the convention Wednesday night, the campaign trotted out the entire clan, unwed hockey mom-to-be, dazed-looking boyfriend and all, and put them literally on stage. Running against the media is a time-honored political tactic. Some pundits have speculated that the McCain camp, by playing the media card at the outset of the general election campaign, is trying to work the refs to make the media self-conscious of how its reporting might be perceived and then to temper its effort. In a blog posting Wednesday, Time magazine's Joe Klein would have none of it. Here's NBC News' Brian Williams quoting Klein on the air.
I hope my colleagues, meaning his colleagues in the news media, stand strong in this case. It's important for the public to know Palin raised taxes as governor, supported the Bridge to Nowhere before she opposed it, pursued pork barrel projects as mayor, tried to ban books at the local library, and thinks the war in Iraq is, quote, a task from God. The attempts by the McCain campaign to bully us into not reporting such things are not only stupidly aggressive, but unprofessional in the extreme.
You'd like to think the press will be unapologetic and uncowed, but don't be too sanguine. Less than 10 minutes later on MSNBC, correspondent Savannah Guthrie, reporting from Palin's hometown, described entering a local bar and asking questions, kind of defensively, kind of meekly, if you ask me.
They were very proud of her and the strong speech she gave tonight. I asked some of the people there, now come on, you may be mad at the media, and they are, but didn't it take you a little while to get used to her too? And they said, yes, it is true that she took some getting used to.
So they're mad. That's their problem, Savannah. It's certainly not yours.
But I want to begin by doing something a little unusual. I'd like to thank the elite media for doing something that, quite frankly, I wasn't sure could be done. And that's unifying the Republican Party and all of America in support of Senator McCain and Palin.
Coming up, one critic says many reporters deserve demerits for their coverage of No Child Left Behind. Also, how to rig an opinion poll.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The RNC balloons barely had time to deflate before the media jumped to assess the impact of the event. A CBS three-day poll released Thursday had the candidates tied at 42%. A Gallup poll over the same period put Obama up by 7 points. A Rasmussen poll ending one day later had Obama at 46% and McCain at 45%. Or if you include leaners, whoever they are, Obama at 48% and McCain at 46%. David Moore was a senior editor at the Gallup poll for 13 years, and in his recent book, The Opinion Makers, he explains why we should take all this poll talk with a huge grain of salt. Consider, he says, the opinion polls in 2003 prior to the war in Iraq. They all showed overwhelming support for the war by a margin around 2-1. But these polls did not give respondents a chance to say they had no opinion, and that, says Moore, severely skewed the results. In fact, the one Gallup poll that did drill down a bit, asking if respondents would be upset if there were no invasion, found that only 29% really favored going to war.
In fact, the public was evenly divided, with a plurality who didn't have an opinion one way or the other. And that, I think, would have been a very different picture of public opinion at the time than the one that was predominantly portrayed in the media, which showed overwhelming support for the war.
And it would have prompted, no doubt, a different response from Capitol Hill.
Yes, I think it's pretty clear that there were many Democrats, particularly in the Senate, who voted for the war, who might very well have voted against it. More importantly, what it did is it reinforced the media coverage, which pretty much went along with what the administration was saying and with what general public opinion was indicating, without essentially going and trying to find opposite points of view.
You say polls fail to reflect again and again and again not only the depth of our commitment, but the depth of our ignorance on an issue.
That's correct. The media polls and the media pollsters refuse to acknowledge that there are probably around 40 to 60% of the public at any given time on any given issue who are really so unengaged in the issue, they really don't have an opinion. Let's take, for example, SCHIP, which is the state child health insurance program. The truth is, a good number of people had no real knowledge of what SCHIP was all about. Well, typically what they got were around 90 to 95% of the people expressing an opinion. And they were very much influenced by the way the question was asked. So, for example, CBS found 81% support for SCHIP because they said, oh, by the way, here's a program that would help poor children get health insurance. Would you like to see that funded or not? And sure enough, they did. Gallup went out and asked a question and said it would be a government program and gave all sorts of other kind of information. Only 41% supported it. A 40-point difference simply in the way the question was asked, and mostly asked of people who didn't know anything about SCHIP except what they've been told by the pollsters themselves.
Let's talk about election polls. You make a point that media and polls that serve the media abhor the undecided voter. And although we see undecideds in every single poll that comes out in an election season, you say that they are never given enough weight.
Yeah, one can take a look, for example, at the recent Gallup daily tracking poll. They asked the question, if the election were held today, who would you vote for, you know, Barack Obama or John McCain? They find that somewhere around 95% of the people have made up their mind. But, of course, the election's not being held today. So it's a hypothetical race. The way you could ask the question is, do you support Obama, do you support McCain, or haven't you made up your mind yet? Right now, there are probably around 35 to 40% of voters who are undecided. Well, I think the reason the media pollsters don't want to emphasize the undecided vote is that they think the media, the journalists, would not be interested in a poll that said there are 40% of the people undecided. You'd say, but gee, if people haven't begun to just make up their minds yet, or such a large segment, why don't we wait and start polling later?
A lot of people who follow the polls are very concerned about the fact that young voters might be underrepresented because they live by cell phone rather than by landline, and so they're harder to find.
There is evidence that suggests that young people who do not have cell phones are different from young people who have cell phones only. Young people who have cell phones only have a different lifestyle. There is a big question in the polling industry as to whether or not we are distorting the results when we don't include cell phones. And the evidence seems to be that with respect to many issues, we are distorting the results. It's not quite clear that with respect to the election issues, we're distorting results, although I would say that by the next election cycle, probably all of the pollsters will have to move to incorporate cell phone-only users into their samples if they don't want to get really wild results.
We've noted the ways that results can be unintentionally distorted, but you also note that there are plenty of ways that they are intentionally distorted.
Well, there was a big example on whether or not there should be oil drilling in ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Frank Luntz was working for a conservative organization, and John Zogby was working for a liberal organization. They asked questions that were essentially the same, but they preceded the questions with different questions so that it influenced what the people said. For example, in Frank Luntz, who wanted to come up with the results that showed that people supported oil drilling, he asked maybe 18 or 19 questions about energy and about the need for getting oil, and then finally said, should we drill for oil in ANWR? On the other side, when John Zogby was doing it for the Wilderness Society, he asked some questions about environment and about protecting the environment, and then finally came and asked about drilling for oil in ANWR, and he found a majority against it. So those kinds of results are more often found among pollsters who are paid by some special interest group to do polling and to come up with results. I don't see those really very intentionally manipulated results occurring amongst the major media pollsters who typically don't have an ideological agenda in mind. Their major agenda is to make sure that they got enough people answering the question so that they don't have to report 40 to 50% of the people who are undecided.
So if leaving out the undecideds skews the results so much, should right-minded pollsters just fall on their swords and stop asking questions that the public can't really answer?
No, I don't think it's good not to ask questions, but I think what's important to do is to ask some preliminary questions. We should say, do you favor it, do you oppose it, or don't you have an opinion? And then among people who have an opinion, I do think we need to know whether they consider it something that's really important or whether it's just a kind of top-of-mind response. Then we could truly find out what the public is thinking, even about arcane subjects. Probably about a lot of them, we're going to have to say, you know, 60% of the public has no idea what's going on. But it seems to me that's a very important part that calls for our political leaders to be leaders, to help educate the public on issues that are really important, rather than just assume that everybody has an opinion and that that opinion is fixed.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke.
David Moore, a senior editor at the Gallup Poll for more than a decade, is currently a senior fellow at the Carsey Institute at the University of New Hampshire. His new book is called The Opinion Makers, An Insider Exposes the Truth Behind the Polls.
So, if the polls give an inaccurate picture of both public opinion and elections, what are we to do? Nate Silver runs the blog 538.com, and his solution is to compile the data from all polls, give weight to those with a proven track record, project data for areas where none is available, and combine everything into a computer algorithm that runs thousands of simulated elections. This way, Silver generates a projected popular vote and, more importantly, a projected tally of the electoral votes, of which there are 538. It might seem like voodoo to take a bunch of wrong answers to create a right one, but in the primaries, Silver's system outperformed other polling organizations.
In North Carolina, which is a state where Obama had been only ahead by 6 or 7 in the polls, if you looked at other southern states that had the same demographics, in all those states he had beaten his polls, it's not that much of a trick to figure out what's going to happen in North Carolina if it's so demographically similar to South Carolina to Virginia. So we didn't look at the polls at all in that case, and we turned out to be, you know, close to the mark. I think we had him at 16 points. He won by 14 or so.
Your reputation is built substantially on your experience with PECOTA, which data mined baseball statistics in order to make predictions about a current year's performance by a player or a team. Tell me about PECOTA and how that informed what you're doing with 538.com.
Yeah, what PECOTA is, it's a projection system. So we tell you, you know, how many home runs Derek Jeter is going to hit every year. And the way it works is to look throughout history for what we call comparable players, and they give you distribution of outcomes. So maybe one player continued to be very good until he was into his 40s. Maybe one player, you know, started to stink and had to retire. Take an average of that. That gives you the projection. We do some similar things at 538. For example, which states are similar to one another? Ohio and Michigan, both very important states. They'll probably move in the same direction from here on out.
Okay, now what about the idea of weighting some poll organizations more heavily than others? How does that work?
Well, we've gone back to 2000 and looked at essentially every election, every poll since then. That includes general elections for Senate and governor, as well as for president, as well as, you know, primaries in 2004 and this year in 2008. Some polls do a better job than others. They're more thorough. They're more scientific. They might have larger sample sizes. So they might be weighted twice as much as a poll with a marginal track record.
As I look at how the polls that you weight are weighted, there are a couple that are just consistently kind of off the charts in inaccuracy. Who's in your hall of shame?
Yeah, there are two. One is Zogby Interactive. Zogby is a pollster who's been around a long time. He's kind of an average pollster, but they have a poll they do purely online where they distribute surveys to people. They can fill them out if they want. You're only going to respond to it if you're motivated by politics, so it's kind of a self-selected sample. The other poll that's really bad is one from the Columbus Dispatch. It's kind of the same thing, really, which is that they mail a ballot out to every voter in Ohio. People only send them back if they're interested in it.
Now, your methodology has taken some criticism in the American Spectator, which is a right-leaning publication. The criticism is that you're just extrapolating current numbers that assumes nothing happens between now and November 4th, 2 months from today.
We don't assume that we know everything. We think there's a pretty big margin of error, literally. We're just trying to say, here's what the relative likelihood of different kinds of things happening. If you average it all together, yeah, the middle point, the median's at about 300 electoral votes for Obama right now, but could go way in another direction. In 1980, for instance, Jimmy Carter had been ahead of Ronald Reagan. They moved into a tie. Then they had a last debate really late, and people kind of flocked to Reagan. The polls didn't even pick it up. He wound up winning by 10 points.
Now, you are a declared supporter of Barack Obama. Why shouldn't we just take everything that you have just said and dismiss it as some sort of spin, you know, under the guise of statistical analysis?
You can. You're welcome to. But we do have 6,000-word-long explanation of how we do everything. So in theory, it should all be reverse engineerable, I think. We've made adjustments at times that have benefited McCain, for instance. You know, there are rules we established. If I make changes, we'll kind of discuss them. It's a good community. You get a lot of smart people contributing. So we try and be as open and transparent as possible. And that includes actually saying who I'm most likely to cast my vote for in November.
Nate Silver runs the blog 538.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's back to school time, and in 50 states, that means kids are back in class experiencing that autumn right we all remember. Being pulled aside by a teacher with a Palm Pilot, measuring basic skills while the rest of the students are busy doing worksheets. This is the era of the federal program called No Child Left Behind, one of the Bush administration's legislative triumphs, at least in the president's opinion. But No Child has been buffeted by criticism almost from the beginning and now is unlikely to be reauthorized by Congress in its current form. According to blogger Alexander Russo, this is just fine with the press, which he says has used No Child Left Behind as a scapegoat for all that ails public education.
I think that the scorn comes from misunderstandings about the law, lack of contextual background in what education is all about and where it's been in the past, and possibly a little bit of prejudice against a law that's affiliated now with a much maligned administration.
Now, back in 2002, when the legislation was signed, it got pretty good reviews. And there were pictures of the president and Senator Ted Kennedy, of all people, at the signing ceremony, all smiles and bipartisanship. It was portrayed in the media, it seems to me, as the realization of the president's Unite, Not Divide campaign theme.
That's right. There was a lot of gee whiz surrounding the law, its size, its ambitiousness, its bipartisanship. It took about 3 or 6 months before the coverage started to turn.
The coverage got critical, which we usually think of as a good thing. But you say it was not merely critical, that it was actually unfair.
Right. Let me start by saying that covering education issues is a difficult and thankless task. Learning is a very difficult thing to measure. Causality is very hard to figure out. But over the months and now years following the passage of the law, it seemed to me that things tended to skew against the law, and the reporting seemed to focus on some things that actually turned out not to be true, that the law was a Bush law when it was a bipartisan law, that there were going to be massive revolts around the country against the law, that people were going to not take the money. This also never happened, that schools were going to be closed and teachers were going to be fired. There were a whole set of these sky is falling things when in reality the law turns out to be a big increase in funding, a rigorous rating system for schools, but not a ton of sanctions. There's no ban on social promotion and No Child Left Behind, and there's no holding kids back or preventing people from graduation. And yet when I'm at a cocktail party or at a school or even talking to teachers, these are some of the things that they think from reading news coverage that seem unfair or unwarranted.
You also mentioned to our producer, Megan Ryan, that the press tended to go for commentary to teachers and principals, the usual suspects, instead of going to education policy experts.
Education reporters out there have some of the same problems that an embedded reporter has in Iraq. That is, they end up seeing the law or its implementation from a very vivid but limited perspective. It would be as if healthcare reporters only talked about healthcare reform by talking to doctors and hospitals. There are a lot of other stakeholders involved. I'm not sure that talking to policy experts is always the way to go. I think that talking to parents and community advocates and the education historians is the way to go to give people more than the complaint of a teacher or the complaint of a superintendent about a law that's being sent to them from far away and is very easy to complain about.
It has been well documented that the newspaper industry is in crisis. What is the future of education reportage in the newspaper environment that we face now?
My sense is that education reporters around the country are a little bit less vulnerable than those on other beats because there is a consistent demand for coverage, at least of what's going on locally in individual schools or in school boards. It's a very low prestige beat. We tend to lose people just as they're getting good. But I don't sense that things are going to go away entirely. There ends up being quite a lot of coverage, especially right now, the sort of back-to-school coverage, what's new, what's different, what's in the backpack. But there's not enough time and space for that kind of quality coverage that we all want. It's great to see people do some amazing time-lapse coverage where they take a kindergarten class and they see how they were affected by various reforms and how they're doing in high school. That type of in-depth quality coverage is sorely lacking.
Alexander, thank you very much.
What an excellent experience.
Alexander Russo writes the blog This Week in Education for Scholastic.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And the Wallace Foundation, whose knowledge center is where education leaders can go to learn about improving teaching and learning. Downloads at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Every year, right about now, college students and their parents confront an ugly reality of higher education: the exorbitant price of textbooks. From Econ 101 to Biology 101, textbooks can cost up to $200 each. But in R. Preston McAfee's undergraduate economics class at the California Institute of Technology, the textbook is free online and just $11 for a print edition. McAfee spent years writing the book, and he hopes this model will one day challenge the traditional textbook industry. He says that these days, most textbook publishers try to create a one-size-fits-all book that can be adopted by any university here and abroad. And that means those costly tomes offer very little content or value to his students.
Students are more serious than they were 30 years ago, and yet the textbooks have gotten easier and easier. What one pundit said is they've replaced the content with pictures of the people who created the content. And as a result, the books are more like advertising the subject than they are about actually learning the subject. So beautiful artwork, beautiful photographs, much less substance.
So in making your book available at virtually no cost, were you responding to what you perceive to be the editorial deficiencies of textbooks in general with the price that publishers are charging? What exactly were you trying to accomplish?
Well, I was asked to teach the intro class at Caltech, and I couldn't bring myself to assign the kind of book that's available in the marketplace. What books are available are $150, and I look at that as a wasted $150. I could have done like many professors and just labored on without a book, but that's also sort of not fair to the students. The students like to be able to review material at home.
For this to have any significance as kind of an economic experiment, it would presume that there are other people like you who are willing to invest 2 or 3 or 4 years of their life writing a textbook for no remuneration.
I think it's pretty well known that the business of professors is the creation and dissemination of knowledge, and I'm no exception. I do a fair amount of research, which I then, like almost every professor in America, give away free. Here, I felt that I could have a bigger impact creating a textbook than in writing more academic papers to be published in ivory tower sort of journals. So I looked at this as being what will give the largest impact for me and for Caltech, who pays my salary. And I actually, before embarking on the project, went and talked to the person in charge of social sciences and said, "This is my thinking. Do you agree?" And the answer was, "Absolutely."
As you say, your bosses at Caltech have said if you want to invest your energies in a textbook, that is great. I'm curious, though, what happens should some commercial publisher want to buy your book and distribute it the traditional way?
I've licensed my book under the Creative Commons license, which means for the rest of time, it's available to anyone else to pick up and edit and produce a new version and use as they see fit, provided they themselves obey the Creative Commons license, which means non-commercial use. That is, they can't make a profit off it. I've actually been approached by a publisher who talked about quite large amounts of money, but in the end, I decided to leave it as it is. In fact, because I've issued it on the Creative Commons license, that actually binds me.
Now, one of the ironies of all of this is that you're not some sort of Bolshevik economist. You believe in the marketplace, and yet you're subverting it here. What's going on?
Well, I don't view this as subversion of the marketplace. I view this as providing a product that the marketplace very much needs, and I'm hopeful that the market will respond and adopt it. One of the things I had hoped for but has not really come to pass was that people would say, yeah, I like McAfee's book, okay, but, you know, I think I can do it better, and that they would then create their own version of it, which was superior. And that kind of competition, taking and building on the base or the framework that I've laid, would produce a book that was truly superior because there were 20 different versions tuned to 20 different audiences. And that's the business model that I think will truly challenge the commercial publishers.
Well, I have no doubts that Introduction to Economic Analysis is a page turner, but if you have no objections, I think I'm just going to wait for the movie.
Well, there is a podcast, although it's pretty hard to follow. It's not likely to be a movie.
Preston, thank you very much.
Thank you.
R. Preston McAfee is the J. Stanley Johnson Professor of Business, Economics, and Management at Caltech.
Come in all sizes, but they loom especially large on the big screen, able to raise up or tear down a child with a word. Sidney Poitier famously played the former in To Sir With Love, so did Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society. But the movies also run amok with pedagogical sadists and bullies. Mostly, they are one or the other. The film may be in color, but the teachers usually are depicted starkly in black or white, and we hardly ever see them teach. One exception is 1955's Blackboard Jungle, starring Glenn Ford.
Now, all your lives you're going to hear stories, what some guy tells you, what you see in books and magazines, on the television, radio, what you read in the newspapers. But if you can just examine the story, look for the real meaning. And most of all, fellas, if you'll just learn to think for yourself.
Here it comes. And here comes the commercial.
We asked Mary Dalton, author of The Hollywood Curriculum, Teachers in the Movies, to outline the traits of the Hollywood pedagogue. She says Blackboard Jungle offers an unusually rich portrayal, but it also set the template for the stock characters that followed. These days, she says, the good teacher rarely deviates from form.
This is something I refer to as the Hollywood model because it's amazing across time how this has been consistent. The good teacher is an outsider, either because this teacher wasn't trained to be a teacher and sort of fell into the profession, or because they're a different race or from a different country. There are all kinds of different ways in which they are outsiders. There's also typically tension between the good teacher and administrators.
So how does this scenario play out in Blackboard Jungle?
Well, in Blackboard Jungle, Glenn Ford plays Mr. Dottier, this teacher fresh out of teacher's college who's idealistic and wants to change the world. And, you know, he's been in a sort of idyllic-looking public school in the suburbs, and he goes to the inner city working with these students who have been deemed incorrigible. And terrible things happen. I mean, you know, they threaten teachers, they steal things, they break things. And in the end, you think he's going to leave the school, but there's this one student, played, of course, by Sidney Poitier, who says,
"There's talk of you quitting the school, going someplace where there's nice little obedient boys and girls."
Now, what do you think?
Well, I figure it's just talk.
Why?
Well, you know the ropes around here pretty good now. Be a shame to waste all that. I guess everybody learns something in school, even teachers.
Yes, I guess so.
So if we skip ahead to the 90s and the aughts, what do movies like 1995's Dangerous Minds, starring Michelle Pfeiffer, and Freedom Riders with Hilary Swank in 2007 have in common?
They still fit the pattern. I mean, of course, Michelle Pfeiffer is an outsider. At the time she gets the job, she's been in the Marines, but she's not fully certified as a teacher yet. They also fit the profile for women teachers. There's a double standard in that male teachers are able to have personal lives, intimate relationships, sustained marriages. Frequently, their love interests are the B story. Women teachers are not. In the case of Dangerous Minds, they actually cast and shot scenes with Andy Garcia as Michelle Pfeiffer's love interest, but cut those before the film was released. I mean, we can't have this mother figure teacher having sex. That would just be horrible. And if they do, in the case of Freedom Riders, for example, the Aaron Gruel character is married, and then midway through the film, her husband says, "You're spending too much time with your students. I need more attention. I'm leaving you."
I just want to live my life and not feel bad about it.
You're my husband. Why can't you stand by me and be a part of it the way wives support husbands?
Because I can't be your wife.
And I think it goes back to the fact that we have this image of the school marm. We're just not comfortable with women teachers on screen as being sexual beings.
Let's talk about the bad teachers now. In the case of women, you have Teaching Mrs. Tingle with Helen Mirren. And, you know, she's just a classic in the genre of the sort of fascistic, power-corrupted monster.
Your work, Mr. Turner, is very reminiscent of a young man who sat in that same chair some 20 years ago. He, too, had the words, "No future," printed on his forehead. Give your father my best.
She really is. It's an over-the-top sort of depiction. But like all of the bad teachers in the movies, what it's really about is her desire to control students.
And you say that when it comes to absolute power, corrupting absolutely, gym teachers are in a filmic league of their own. Have we made no progress?
The stereotypes are in greatest proportion with these gym teacher characters. I almost hesitate to mention the film Porky's.
Please
will
do.
Will people think less of me if I mention Beulah Ballbricker, who's just iconic? But I think the one people think about a lot is the film Carrie, where you have the Miss Collins character who at first appears to want to help Carrie, but she just cannot get out of that mode of wanting to exert control.
What I said at the top of this interview is that mostly teachers are depicted starkly in terms of black and white, but in recent years there have been a few signs of more complex characters, neither all good or all bad. The crack-addicted teacher in Half Nelson is a complete mess.
Well, he is a complete mess as a person, but I have never before or since seen such a wonderful example of critical pedagogy working in the classroom.
History is the study of change over time. And what's change? It's this, it's opposites. It's two things that push against each other in opposite directions. So the civil rights movement, okay? It's essentially, it's two opposing mentalities. In the South, the majority believes all men are not created equal. And there's a minority who believes that they are. So that minority struggles, and it fights, and it pushes, till eventually it becomes the majority.
You can't reduce him to a good teacher or a bad teacher.
And then, of course, there's that other character played by Matthew Broderick in Election. I mean, this, unlike the character in Half Nelson, is a fundamentally unlikable character, in my view. Was he a good teacher or a bad teacher?
Well, I find him fundamentally likable because I feel so sorry for him. He has been the exemplar teacher for years, winning the teaching award. I mean, clearly he's into this. And then he makes a terrible mistake by trying to fix the student government elections. But the thing that I find so interesting about this film is that he really doesn't deviate much from this pattern of the good teacher, but he's a much more nuanced character.
It's hard to remember how the whole thing started. The whole election mess. What I do remember is that I loved my job. I was a teacher, an educator, and I couldn't imagine doing anything else. And I cared.
Come on, Wolverines! Defense!
And I think I made a difference. I knew I touched the students' lives during their difficult young adult years, and I took that responsibility seriously.
You've been writing most recently about the portrayals of teachers on TV, which you say has outpaced film long, long ago. What can we find on TV that we can't find in cinema?
Well, we found a complex, sympathetic portrayal of a gay teacher in television remarkably before in film in My So-Called Life. Mm-hmm. We also see women teachers have sex.
Hallelujah.
And that came after The Gay Teacher. That was with Boston Public. No negative repercussions. The world did not end. But my favorite representation of a teacher on television is Roland Prezbalewski, Prez, on season 4 of The Wire.
I still have a lot of kids who can barely handle whole numbers.
Please, you don't teach math. You teach the test. North Avenue is all about the leave no child behind stuff, getting spoon-fed.
And what do they learn?
The way this series takes a white teacher in an inner-city Baltimore school without privileging his experience over the kids or any of the things that happen so often in the films like Freedom Riders and Dangerous Minds is really incredible. And then plus the systemic critique of educational policies and the system at every level is unlike anything I've ever imagined.
So what you're saying is that it's such a complicated business depicting teachers that it's very hard to do in the length of an ordinary film. You need hour-long segments in a 13-hour season.
If you're really going to look at educational policy issues, and if you're going to look at the things that students deal with in their daily lives and then the pressures on teachers, you're right.
Mary Dalton is an associate professor of communication at Wake Forest University and the author of The Hollywood Curriculum, Teachers in the Movies. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In 1930, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, in an effort to alleviate the effects of the, anyone, the Great Depression, passed the, anyone, the Hawley-Smoot Tariff Act, which, anyone, raised or lowered, anyone,
even a third-rate film still has one last chance to be first-rate entertainment in the preview. If nothing else, there's got to be at least 2 minutes in there somewhere.
John Rambo was innocent.
I didn't do anything!
They pushed him too far.
I'm starting to dislike you.
A lot. One man who'll never give up.
Don LaFontaine died this week at the age of 68. You may not know his name, but I know you know his voice. For 33 years, LaFontaine owned those 2 minutes of gut-shaking, tightly edited highlights. It was his gravelly, ignore-me-at-your-peril delivery that made every movie preview sound like this.
The good. The bad. The ugly.
In some 5,000 previews and countless commercials, LaFontaine intrigued you, beguiled you, scared you a little, because suddenly you were
in a world of danger.
Or
in a world where change is often frightening.
Or even
in a world of falafel and pizza. Stand in the line for the best sabich in the universe.
In a brief video tribute, the inventor of In a World explains that his extraordinary magic sprang from a pretty ordinary place.
When I was 13 years old, my voice changed in the middle of a sentence. Mom, I'll help you with the dishes. Literally. And for a while there was, it really upset me, but then I discovered that I could be everybody's dad. Jimmy can't come to school today because he's not feeling very well.
He valued his gift, and he shared it. For years, he recorded answering machine messages for any stranger who asked. Once, on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, when he failed to win a listener Carl Castle's voice on their machine, he offered to do it himself. In a world where unique talent deserves recognition, we salute you, Don LaFontaine. Also, we have a special respect, envy, really, for anyone who can enthrall with only the sound of his voice.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson, engineering help from Zach Marsh, and more help from Michael Bernstein. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
In a world where co-hosts say their last line.
Give it up, Bob.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.